From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Cornell William Brooks, president of the NAACP, talks about his recent protest of Senator Jeff Sessions' nomination as Attorney General. Oscar winner Matthew McConaughey talks about his latest film. It's called Gold, and renowned classical musician Itzhak Perlman reflects on his career. But first, President Donald Trump is expected to announce his Supreme Court pick to fill the vacancy left by the late Antonin Scalia very soon. Even though he hasn't announced his choice yet, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has vowed to oppose anyone he believes is, quote, out of the mainstream, close quote. So it looks like the president will have a battle on his hands. Joining me now to talk about the future of the Supreme Court and more are Adam Winkler, constitutional law scholar at the UCLA School of Law, and Melissa Murray, interim dean of UC Berkeley School of Law.
Glad to have both of you here. First, this comment that he made, that millions of illegals voted, and that is the reason why he did not win the popular vote. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty close to what he said, to which Lindsey Graham and other Republican senators have ripped him to shreds, because it makes a statement about the democracy. And when the president suggests that our democracy was undermined that way, and that's why he didn't win the popular vote, it's not just, this isn't just somebody talking trash. This is a serious issue. What did you make of that?
Well, for the first thing, I think was interesting about the statement is, like, it shows how rattled he is by the idea that he didn't win the popular vote, that he was elected by the Electoral College, but failed to connect with the majority of the American people. And that clearly rankles. But the whole idea that voter fraud was rampant is really interesting given the spate of voter ID laws that we've seen over the last 10 years. I mean, it's actually harder to vote now.
Pushed by Republicans, I might
Yes. Like, it's really hard to vote, and certainly harder to perpetrate voter fraud. So the idea that there's just rampant voter fraud and this somehow contributed to an excess of the popular vote seems preposterous. But again, it's something that he really believes in, and it lays a foundation for future voter ID laws or future laws that restrict the right to vote.
When asked about this, Mr. Spicer, the new press secretary who we all got to know with his initial lie to the American people about the inauguration numbers, when asked about this issue, he said, and I'm again, quoting pretty close to what he said, that the president believes what the president believes. No facts, no data. The president believes what the president believes. How do we advance, Adam, in an era where the president believes what he believes? There's no data, there are no facts, and you are denigrating the way the democracy works.
Well, the truth is, I think it's really going to fall on people like you, Tavis, on the journalists, to really call them out on it, to call these lies lies, because that's what they are. And to be really clear, we've had a lot of studies about voting in America, and we know that the kind of voter fraud, like impersonation and whatnot, very, very rare. It almost never happens. It's just not a very effective way to commit voter fraud, even if you wanted to swing an election. So we know this is just not happening, and we need the media and people like Melissa and I will be out here ready to come on and point out these lies.
Speaking of media, speaking of journalists, the problem with that theory is that journalists, I think, or some of them at least, are already being frozen by fear. When you have a White House that on day one comes out through the press secretary and just tells a flat-out lie, then they send their people out, whether it's Mr. Priebus or, you know, Kellyanne Conway on the Sunday morning shows, and they try to, you know, temper the lie to some degree but not call it what it is. So this is rampant inside his inner circle, these lies and the spin. Then the president has famously taken after certain networks and certain reporters. The point I'm getting to is whether or not, Melissa, you think in the short run we are going to see reporters who are frozen by fear because they feel that these First Amendment rights that they are guaranteed are under attack.
I think this is a twofold strategy. Yeah. One is to have a chilling effect on the free press. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, I think, is to sort of establish a baseline for Trump supporters and others who may be on the fence that the media is somehow illegitimate. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's sort of a destabilizing effect. So when people talked about the Sean Spicer press conference, it was sort of funny. Like, you know, how could he, you know, inflate the number of people at the inauguration or possibly deflate the number of people at the protest? But I don't think that was the issue at all. The issue is to create doubt in the minds of the American people about what the media says, so that when the media does begin to report on more egregious breaches, there isn't the trust that previously existed.
How afraid should we be? How fragile is our democracy when the president is enacting that two-part strategy?
I think we should be afraid. I think you already see efforts to not only chill the press and the media, but also anyone else who might speak and voices of dissent more generally. So there was a Public Records Act request of law professors at public schools in Georgia who had signed the letter protesting the nomination of Jeff Sessions to be attorney general. I mean, that's the kind of clear statement to public intellectuals or academics that dissenting voices will not be tolerated. And I don't think it's going to have any traction, but it is meant to make people think twice before they register their dissent.
There's a lawsuit that's been filed now that says that President Trump is in violation of the U.S. Constitution. There is a prominent bipartisan ethics and constitutional group of experts, including former ethics attorneys for George Bush and Barack Obama. The suit has been filed along with the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, better known as CREW. And this lawsuit is basically about, my favorite word, emoluments. So there's an emoluments clause that President Trump, we are told, is in violation of, having to do with his various business holdings. We are told that he has about 500, he's linked, his companies are linked to over 500 entities in at least 25 different countries, and that he is, this lawsuit suggests, already in violation of the emoluments clause of the Constitution. Now, since I didn't go to law school, somebody explain that to me.
There's a section in the Constitution that says that no person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall receive any present, emolument, office, or salary from any king, prince, or foreign state. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of case law on this because every president going back to George Washington has thought, okay, I need to divest myself of my assets so that I can, or put it in a blind trust, put them in a blind trust so that I don't have any emoluments issues coming to me. But that's not what's happening here. And so we're not sure exactly what the Supreme Court will say, but it's pretty clear that an emolument is any kind of gift that comes to you because of your office. And any time someone comes to stay in a Trump hotel, for instance, in Washington, D.C., so that they can say to the president, I'm staying in your hotel, isn't that great? Or I'm holding an event in your hotel so I can impress the president. That's going to cause a potential emoluments clause violation. And we've already seen these issues arise. I mean, when the president of Turkey announced that Donald Trump had to take his name off a new Trump hotel that was opening up in Turkey after Donald Trump said we were going to ban Muslims from entering the country, it looked like it was a real problem for Donald Trump. Well, he came out right after that and complimented the president of Turkey for cracking down on dissidents. And the next thing you know, the president of Turkey is like, okay, you can put your name back on it. Now, did Donald Trump do that, support that Turkish president to support his own business interest or to support the national interests of the United States? We shouldn't have to ask that question, and the framers didn't want us to ask that question.
Let me make a bold prediction, really, that this president is going to be sued more than any president in the history of the country. True or false? There'll be more lawsuits filed against him, against his administration, than any presidency. Would you take that bet?
We have a lawsuit on day one, so why not?
Yeah. Look, and he'd be bragging about it, too, Donald Trump. You know, I've got more lawsuits than any other president of the United States. But I think that's right, and I do think that his unwillingness to divest or to put his assets in a blind trust, he really seems like he's unwilling to make any concession in that regard, really. I think it's going to be a continuing problem for him. It's going to be an open wound that will cause more and more scandals to arise.
I mean, I think Adam's exactly right. He may be the most sued president in history. He won't care. I mean, for the same reason he has been excoriated for refusing to disclose his tax returns, and he doesn't care. I mean, so this isn't business as usual. This is not normal politics.
And then there is, of course, the big issue, as if these issues aren't already overwhelming. The big issue, which will come in a week or two, we are told, is his Supreme Court nominee to take the seat from the deceased Justice Antonin Scalia. We all remember Merrick Garland was nominated. That really went nowhere. Republicans said, we're not going to take it up. They kept true to their word. They did not take it up. So President Trump has won. He gets to put somebody in that seat now. What do we make of what this process is going to look like?
Elections have consequences, and one of the consequences is that the president gets to nominate his own prospect for the Supreme Court. And I think three names have been floated: Judge Hardiman from Pittsburgh, Bill Pryor from Alabama, and then, of course, Neil Gorsuch from Colorado. And all are very conservative judges. I think there's probably going to be pressure on President Trump to pick the one that can garner some bipartisan support. But what I think is interesting about this is that none of these judges could reasonably be called moderate. They are actually quite conservative in their judicial philosophies. What's actually different, though, is that the baseline of what's acceptable now seems to have moved so far. So my pick would personally be for Neil Gorsuch, because he really is a great judicial craftsman. He writes really interesting opinions. He's sort of a textualist and an originalist in the Scalia mold. He seems to be an appropriate replacement for Justice Scalia. Bill Pryor has a long history of advocating against LGBTQ rights in Alabama as attorney general, against abortion and women's rights, things of that nature. So I think he'll have a harder row to hoe at confirmation. But Neil Gorsuch seems like someone that everyone can get down with. And that's really interesting, because I don't think that's where we would have been a year ago.
Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, of course, who is the minority leader, has already said that the Democrats will oppose anyone who is put forth who is outside of the mainstream. And to your point, I'm not sure we know where the lines are anymore, Adam, in terms of what a mainstream candidate would look like. Because Merrick Garland doesn't fit that. Nobody does.
That's right. I mean, Merrick Garland was very much a right down the middle kind of guy. But it's different. You know, politics have shifted. A country has shifted to the right. I don't know if the American people's attitudes have shifted to the right, but the people that were electing president and into Congress and Senate clearly are shifting to the right. And as a result, we're going to have, in one sense, a Supreme Court that continues the old Supreme Court. We're replacing Scalia with another real conservative. So it's going to be a continuation of the court in some ways. But we should recognize that we were really on the verge of having a Supreme Court with a liberal Democratic appointed majority for the first time in 50 years. And that was a stolen seat, I think, by the Senate Republicans. And the question is, I think, really for the Democrats, how did they play hardball as effectively as the Republicans?
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. NAACP President Cornell William Brooks made news recently when he and his colleagues were arrested for staging a sit-in protest at the office of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, President Trump's pick for Attorney General. Mr. Brooks has also shared his concerns about Trump's Education Secretary nominee, Betsy DeVos. Mr. Brooks is here now to share his thoughts with us.
Mr. President, good to have you on this program, sir.
It's great to be here, Tavis.
Honored to have you. So the nomination of Senator Sessions, which we had Senator Cory Booker on this program last week, who courageously came out against a sitting senator.
That's right.
To oppose his nomination. That, you know, those hearings have now been postponed. So what do you expect is going to happen?
Well, we are hopeful.
Yeah.
Here's what we notice. They are, there's a super PAC that is running ads in support of Senator Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General. That is rare, if not unprecedented. And what that suggests to us is that we may not yet be winning, but we're certainly gaining.
Yeah.
Because the phone lines at the Capitol have been inundated with phone calls from people all across the country who are stating their objections to having, as Attorney General, a senator who has declined to support efforts to fight voter suppression while mouthing support for the myth of voter fraud. They are declining to support an attorney general who's called for the law and order in the most Nixonian and draconian terms, who supports a president who wants to expand stop and frisk. This attorney general nominee is an anathema to many Americans, not because he's not a collegial senator in the Senate, but rather he lacks the prosecutorial credibility to enforce the laws on behalf of everyone at the Department of Justice.
Speaking of voter fraud, what do you make of these comments by the president that millions of undocumented Americans voted and that's why he didn't win the popular vote? What's wrong with him?
I can't speculate as to what's wrong with the president, but I can certainly speculate as to what is wrong with his set of alternate facts. Here's what we know. Scholars will tell you there's a study that has shown out of a billion ballots cast, literally a handful of instances of voter fraud. We can go from one end of the country to the other. We find federal courts who are siding with the NAACP again and again and again in terms of voter suppression as opposed to voter fraud. Mm-hmm. Voter fraud is the myth that is used as a pretext for enacting laws that are voter suppressive.
Pushed by Republicans.
Pushed by Republicans. Yeah. So when we have these voter ID laws, where the legislators know that one out of every 10 African Americans does not have a government issued photo ID, where they know that, they're seniors who do not have these IDs. They know that these laws are designed to prevent African Americans from voting. Think about this. In Texas, you pass a law which says if you have an ID which allows you to carry a concealed weapon, deemed to be sufficient civic and democratic proof to vote. But an ID which allows you to carry a book of English, a book of chemistry, a book of engineering, a book of Shakespeare, deemed to be insufficient civic or democratic proof to vote. That law was struck down by the Fifth Circuit as a consequence of the litigation and advocacy of the NAACP. Over in the Fourth Circuit in North Carolina, they passed a law which basically rolls back all of these measures which encourage people to vote. And it rolled back a voter ID law. In fact, the court found that the state legislature engaged in intentional racial discrimination carried out with surgical precision. The point being is the president should know what the federal courts have recognized. Namely, voter fraud is a myth. Yeah. Voter suppression is ugly and real and ongoing. Mm-hmm.
What do you expect or not expect this president will do the next time, sadly, there is an African-American male or female shot and killed by a cop? I saw in these rallies across the country last weekend, which was very empowering to see.
Indeed.
These women rallies in this country and around the globe, and there was a Black Lives Matter presence at most of these, if not all of these rallies, and it made me think, respectfully, when the country feels that white women's lives are under attack, we show up and take to the streets, and I'm all for that.
Sure.
But we don't see that same kind of turnout. We don't see those same kind of numbers when the lives of Black men and women are snuffed out. What's your sense of what's going to happen when that sad occasion occurs again?
I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I'm concerned. I won't say fearful because we don't take counsel of our fears. But we're very concerned because we're headed toward a kind of catastrophic train wreck unless we reverse course in terms of policy. If you have an attorney general who supports the expansion of stop and frisk, who supports the expansion of the prison industrial complex, who is not concerned about the 2.3 million Americans behind bars, the 70 million Americans with criminal records, and who has a record that is frankly runs counter to what red and blue state governors are doing. In other words, they're trying to dismantle this prison industrial complex. So if we have an attorney general like that going into Freddie Gray's Baltimore, into Tamir Rice's Cleveland, into Sandra Bland's Texas, or Eric Garner's Long Island, the next time there's a tragedy, we're going to have a problem. Because you have millennial activists and Motown activists in the streets who are not going to capitulate, who are not going to compromise. They're not going back. And in fact, we are trying to inch our way forward. And so we've got to be very clear about this.
Well, and he's been very clear about law and order, law and order, law and order. He hit that theme in his inauguration address, as a matter of fact. So it seems pretty clear to me what the response from the White House is going to be when that dreaded moment comes.
Well, I will simply say this. We are prepared to work with the administration for the advancement of constitutional principles and constitutional values and an end to stop and frisk and an end to racial profiling and an end to the predatory policing that we see in so many of our cities. But as we said on day one after the election, depending on this president's constitutional fidelity, we're prepared to either be at his side or be in his face. And if you're talking about the taking of innocent lives, Black lives, or whatever color they happen to be, the NAACP will be in strong opposition. And that means being in the streets.
Yeah.
That means going to jail. That means engaging in massive civil disobedience. And I would note this. I believe the next time you have a tragedy under this administration, you're going to see many more people turning out.
In the streets.
In the streets.
Yeah.
And what I've seen traveling around the country is that the people in the crowds are multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-generational.
Yeah.
And so it's going to expand, it's going to grow. We're in the Twitter age civil rights movement.
Let me shift from the AG nomination to the education nomination
yes,
right
sir.
Quick. So Betsy DeVos, it would appear from what I've read and heard her say that she thinks that charter schools are the answer to everything. Mm-hmm. Privatization seems to be the answer to everything these days. Right. Additionally, what's your read on the new potential new education secretary?
We're concerned, and concerned as in we think there's much to be alarmed about. Mm-hmm. Nominating someone whose distinguishing qualification is having contributed lots of money to charter school support campaigns, particularly in Michigan. Michigan is a state that spends $1 billion on charter schools, that has the worst oversight, the worst accountability standards, and we have a Secretary of Education nominee with no experience in education from as a matter of policy, as a matter of practice, but she has experience in charter school advocacy support. Mm-hmm. That's not enough. Yeah. And where we know we're at a moment in this country where people are looking for accountability and responsibility. And so where you have states in the country that have seen the funding of their school system turned upside down, here's what we mean. If you support charter schools in ways that are lacking in accountability, mm-hmm. and charter schools, some of them, want to support and educate those who are least expensive to educate while kicking out and declining to educate those who are more expensive to educate. Children who are not, for whom English is not their first language, children who have special needs, mm-hmm. children who need more. They're as brilliant, as capable, as talented, but they need more. We have seen school systems where the funding has been turned upside down. In other words, the public school system as a whole has been effectively defunded. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that in Michigan. We've certainly seen in Massachusetts where they put a cap on the expansion of charter schools. And so where you have a Secretary of Education nominee who wants to write a blank check to the charter school movement, we can't get beyond that. We can't support that. And where you have a nominee who supports privatization of public education. Yeah. Now, let me put it this way. If we are alarmed by repeal while declining to replace in the context of health care,
yeah, sure.
why wouldn't we be positively frightened by the prospect of repeal and declining to replace in the context of public education?
It's not even, and I take your point, and I totally agree, it's not even just that you have an education nominee who hasn't really operated in that realm. That's true of other nominations as well. With all due respect to Dr. Ben Carson, he don't know nothing about housing except the fact he probably owns a couple. But he's nominated for the Hudson. I mean, what do you make of these nominees who don't seem to have any track record of experience in the areas for which they've been nominated to have oversight?
Well, here's our concern. What we are seeing is an ideological litmus test,
yeah.
as opposed to a qualification check. Mm-hmm. So where we have seen in the course of this nomination process a kind of conveyor belt where we're pushing through these ideologically driven nominees without ethics checks, without sufficient vetting, in a hurried way. It's sort of like that person in the express line in the grocery store who has 100 items in their cart. And then the lane that's marked 15 items.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what we're seeing here is a process where we're trying to jam these people through as though the American public is not paying attention. But what are we seeing? We're seeing the phone lines for the United States Senate inundated with phone calls from blue and red states. We're seeing voicemails filled up. Why? Because people refuse to capitulate and compromise with respect to their democracy.
Mr. President, I thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good to have you on this program.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Matthew McConaughey is best known for his roles in projects like Dallas Buyers Club, for which he won the Best Actor Oscar, and the critically acclaimed TV series True Detective. His latest film is called Gold, and in it, McConaughey plays a businessman who is desperate for a lucky break, and inspired by a dream, he travels to Indonesia in search of his fortune. Matthew, good to have you on the program, sir.
I've been reading so much about this film in preparation for our conversation. And this film has been, I don't want to say maligned, But it certainly has been framed and talked about and critiqued as a film about greed. Mm-hmm. And we've seen many of those films. And there's some greed in it, to be sure, no doubt about that. But to my mind, it is a film about outsized ambition and this drive to succeed at whatever cost. How do you see the film?
Well, I would agree with you. I don't see it as much about greed. I mean, once Kenny gets the money.
Kenny Wells
gets the money or has found the gold. There's a lot of greed. New York comes after him.
Sure.
The big people, the suits come after his money, and just for the money. But for Kenny, it's and there's a great scene in here where he says, look, for me, it was about the gold. It was never about the money. Mm-hmm. Gold's different. So what was the gold for Kenny Wells? Kenny's a guy who inherited his grandfather's company from his father when it was, and he inherited it in healthy shape. Mm-hmm. And he rode it into the ground, and the economy went down. But he didn't want to break that chain by any means necessary. He was not going to break that chain. Mm-hmm. He hocks a watch, takes a one-way ticket to Indonesia to chase down a literal dream he has, knowing where the gold is, on a wing and a prayer, mm-hmm. and makes it happen. He almost wills it to happen. So the gold for him was the chasing of the dream, the chasing it down, the by any means necessary, whatever it takes, mm-hmm. prove them all wrong. I never got a ticket to the American dream. I was never going to get a ticket to the American dream like millions of people in the world. But I'm going to make it happen by hook or by crook. I'm going to out-hustle everybody mm-hmm. else. I'm going to will this thing to happen. That's the gold,
yeah.
You know.
I am not an actor, and you should be glad that I'm not. I'm not a thespian, but I love film. And the films I love the most are the ones that give me a clear route, a clear path into reveling in, celebrating, wrestling with the humanity of the character. Yeah. When you took this project on or decided to take it on, what route did you take into understanding, appreciating, embracing his humanity?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And with Kenny, you know, his humanity came a lot when I first read it. It was the second script I ever read where I said, oh, I know this guy from the inside out. It hit me like a lightning bolt. And even before I went and did the research on the real mm-hmm. Kenny Wells, who was named David Walsh, who I had a lot mm-hmm. of research and facts to find out about him, it hit me immediately, oh, I know this. This was part of who my dad was. It's part of who my dad did business with. It's the Chuck Buzons. It's these Chicago Johns, these people that I saw my dad dealing with. And they were pipe and coupling salesmen. They were mm-hmm. not prospectors. But in a way, they were prospectors. Yeah. They were peddling every day, waking up in the morning, throwing their legs over the side of the bed, going, today's going to be the day. And my dad's line was, I'm going to hit a lick. Boys, wish me luck. I'm going to hit a lick. And that means I'm going to make a big sale.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he didn't hit that lick.
Yeah.
And he got up again the next day. Mm-hmm. Today's going to be the day. I'm going to hit a lick. And he didn't for days, for weeks, for months, for years, until mm-hmm. he moved on. There's millions of people like that. And this is a story with Kenny. He actually did find the gold. He actually did hit that lick. So, you know, a lot of it was research I did on the guy, David Walsh, who original name, the true character for Kenny Wells. And then a lot of it, just instinctually, it was not an intellectual exercise, instinctually took me back to impressions I had of my father and places that he took me when I was 12 years old, when he took me around the country to go collect from people that owed him money, bringing it along a 12-year-old would mm-hmm. shame some of them into paying him back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, behind the abandoned shopping mall deals to buy hot watches just because it was hot.
Yeah.
You know, just because. And him, like, you know, I remember him, like, he'd look in the sky like there were helicopters following us or something.
Yeah.
Nobody gave a damn he was buying that hot watch behind the abandoned shopping mall, but that was what kind of turned him on. And yet he was larger than life. He was a consumer of life, like Kenny Wells. It was whether it was the food, the drink, the love, the joy, the smoke. He was larger than life, in spirit and in size.
How did you process at that age, watching all that your father was doing? How did you process that?
Well, one, I was happy to be along.
Sure, sure.
I could go along. Yeah. I could hear. You know, my dad loved to set up the story. You know, mm-hmm. hey, this, stay in the car. This is Chicago John. You know, while he leaves the car running. You know, and gets out, and Chicago John's in a white van.
Right.
5'4", balding, with a red leather jacket on a cold Southwest Houston day. And he goes to the back of the van, and there's hair dryers and washing machines and a glove box. And I'm just watching. And, whatever was in that glove box that my dad paid for made my dad's shoulders go like this, and they walked away without a handshake or anything. It was like this is a deal we made. And my dad, getting in the car, handed me this wadded up roll of paper towels with something in it and saying, put it in the glove box, buddy. Make sure it doesn't get away. And I'm like, oh, what is it? This is great. What is it? And then driving down the road for 10 minutes and him going, check the glove box, see if it's still there. I open the glove box and I pull it out, and it's a big silver watch.
Right.
And my dad's like, damn, buddy, that's a $22,000 Rolex, titanium, and I just bought it for $3,000. Hey, I was wow. I was so happy to be along for the ride, to hear his stories on the way, driving around the country to go collect from these people. So it was a big rite of passage that he took me along. Right. I had two older brothers that were doing business with him, so they got to be part of these stories.
Yeah.
I got to be an observer, and it's very interesting because a lot of it, like that story I just tell, that's how I remember going down.
Yeah.
But that's 16-year-old eyes watching my dad.
Yeah.
Did it go down exactly like that? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it should have.
Yeah. What you learned, and I say this, you'll take my point. I say this in the affirmative, not the negative.
Mm.
What you learned from watching your father about how to get your hustle on?
How to get the hustle on?
Yeah. What you learned about getting your hustle? Because you've clearly done that in your career.
Sure.
What you learned about hustle?
Self-reliance.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to take care of you but you.
Mm.
Get up every day. If you get out of bed, he loves to say that. How's the day? Well, I got out of bed this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't tell. We had times in the late 70s where we were high on the hog. The oil boom had hit.
Mm-hmm.
We had a matching jet boat with the matching Learjet, and that all just crashed. Mm-hmm. And then we were broke. And he wouldn't go Chapter 11 or Chapter 13. He had too much pride to go bankrupt. But you couldn't tell in our family any difference from when we were rich or when we were broke.
Oh.
From his attitude, you couldn't tell.
Mm-hmm.
He was still the host of the day. He was still extremely positive, extremely physical, and was going to go make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think I learned a lot of resilience from him, because I didn't find out till post-mortem after he moved on how hard times were for our family that last 5 years before he moved on.
Mm-hmm.
So resilience, you know, our family preaches a pretty hardcore positive attitude as a means of survival.
Yeah.
Not just to be happy with the day, but no, you got to go make it happen and get relative real quick. Our family's very good about that. You better get relative when you think you got it tough.
Mm-hmm.
You better get relative, because a whole lot of people have got it tougher. So I think we weren't a family that allowed much drama.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get dramatic or in our family at all about much, because they'd bring you to the ground and humble you real quick.
Yeah. What do you use for motivation? And I ask that because it is impossible to even mention the name Matthew McConaughey without everybody doing their own impersonation.
Okay.
One way or the other.
Right.
I'm not going to do it, but yeah,
right.
We all got our Matthew McConaughey.
Okay.
All right. Anyway.
First three words you ever said, true.
Yeah. So everybody has their Matthew McConaughey moment. And but those moments, whatever they are, they're always rooted, I'm talking about your personality, not the characters you play, they're always rooted in a positivity. In a fight, in a resistance, you know, what motivates you? How do you sustain your hope? What do you hold on to every day?
Well, the best, as much as I've thought about it over the years, and the best I could come up with what gives me happiness or satisfaction is having something to look forward to. Having kids. It's a daily thing to look forward to until they're out of the house, you know, I suppose. But I've always needed a certain stake in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too good with too many Saturdays in a row. I like my Saturdays, but too many Saturdays in a row, I get a little wobbly. So I like something to look forward to and chase down.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant when I get asked about that Oscar speech. What do you mean, your hero's you 10 years from now? Because it gives me something to chase, you know, to be the man I'm trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
I got to remind myself often, hey, just sit still.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because my favorite thing in life where I find that I'm the most turned on is on the approach.
Mm-hmm.
On the approach. Mm-hmm. On the come.
Mm-hmm.
Moving in is a lot more fun than moving out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got you.
So
after films are done, do you crash and burn? Like, the approach is the fun part for you, when you rap, what do you do?
Oh, I take a 19-hour nap.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, and usually catch a cold.
Right.
Because when defense system went down and go kick back and press reset for a couple of weeks. You know, I mean, I grew up, like I said earlier about the family, you know, optimism and resilience. And almost to the too much degree. I tell my mom today, I said, Mom, you told us to get up and dust ourselves off so quickly. We forgot to even take inventory on why the hell we had to dust ourselves off. And we repeated we repeated the action. I was like, we never had a winter time in our household. It was summertime 12 months a year. And so I've learned, and I give my mom heck about it. She's 85. I was like, no, it's nice to have a little repose during the year, take a little inventory on the year so we can evolve. I need a little bit of winter time. She's 85. I can't argue with her. She's like, oh, well, why would you want to do that?
Matthew McConaughey is the man, and I have so enjoyed this conversation with him. I'm sure you enjoyed it as well. And would have loved to be here, but anyway, I was here. Sorry. the film is called Gold. It is a powerful film, and I think you'll enjoy it. Matthew, thank you for coming by to see us, my friend.
My pleasure, Travis.
Pleasure's mine. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. World-renowned classical musician Itzhak Perlman has performed in venues all over the globe and has collaborated with the likes of Yo-Yo Ma, Placido Domingo, and the piano legend Martha Argerich, with whom he released a studio album last year. He's currently on a 10-city tour and will go to Israel in March to conduct the Philharmonic there. He joins us now, though, to talk about his work. Mr. Perlman, good to have you back on the program, sir.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. Yes. Let me start, I think, with a... I didn't ask your permission to ask you this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. If you want to slap me...
You can't ask me. Sorry.
If you want to slap me, you can. So we all remember so fondly and so beautifully your performance at the Obama inauguration in 2009. Mm-hmm. So you know where I'm going with this, right?
Oh, I'm afraid I do.
had you been asked to perform at the inauguration that had the greatest turnout of any inauguration in the country's history.
Any. The greatest.
The greatest ever.
The greatest ever.
Had you been asked to perform there, would you have?
No.
No.
But it's a moot point. I wasn't asked. So, No. I couldn't. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. Too many things against it. So, and besides, I don't know how cold was. How cold was it? I don't, because with the Obama...
I think it was colder for Obama than it was
For the Obama,
Trump.
It was
sure,
incredibly
it was incredibly cold.
Cold,
you know,
we had those little chemical things for our for our fists so that we won't freeze. No, I wouldn't have. No, absolutely.
Let me piggyback on that then.
All right.
And I'm really curious to get your take on this, as I am of most artists, but you at a different level than most artists. What is the role of the artist in moments like these? Because the great Paul Robeson once said that artists are the gatekeepers of truth. That's Robeson. But what's your sense of what the role, I think, the ever-important role of the artist is in a moment like this?
Well, artist is to define society, I think. You know, without artists, our society is less. This goes to the artists, it goes to the arts, to music and culture and so on and so forth. That's all one package that helps us define who we are as a society. And the minute something happens that is against that kind of artistry and so on, I think society suffers. So I think that we are, I suppose we can speak, I'm not sure that politics and should be so connected. I'm not sure. I think that what we do should speak for itself, I think. You know, but everybody has their own way of thinking about it. You know, some people like to express themselves more than others and so on.
If you're right about the fact that the artist's work, in your case, the artist's music, ought to speak for herself or himself, in your case, what do you hope your music has been saying to us all these years?
I hope my music brought beauty, brought feeling of... I suppose if things don't go well, I suppose a feeling of escape. You know, you see, you know, I mean, one of the things that that I always think about is when Israel was being attacked by all the Scud missiles, you know, the concert halls were filled with people. They wanted to escape. They wanted to hear some art. They wanted to hear some wonderful music and forget about what goes on. Yeah. So it's one way of looking at it.
Yeah. Tell me more about this Genesis Prize. There are folk
That's called the Giving Back Prize.
Yes. Tell me more about that.
Well, it's a what they say they like to call it the Jewish Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. And so what is it? It's basically they give you money in order to give back.
Yeah.
So in other words, the prize that you get, you know, to say that it's $1 million prize and everybody says, oh my God, it's fantastic. I said, no. I get the money, but I give it right back. Not because I choose to, because I have to. Mm-hmm. And it's a question. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's part of the deal.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a question of giving to charity, you know. So now, what better thing can you imagine but to be able to give back to charity?
Right.
To give back to things that you like, the things that you see that you like to help. Yeah. You know, my attitude is that I'd like to give to organizations that maybe are not the biggest organizations, mm-hmm. but they have maybe smaller budget, so that every little money, every little dollar really, really counts.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm doing. You know, it's a big work. You know, this prize is not just, oh, it's an honor. Yes, it's an honor, but you have to work.
Yeah.
You have to figure out who you want to give it to, you know, what kind of organization. I basically like to give to organizations that close to me, which is in music, mm-hmm. and of course in the problems of the disabled.
Right.
So that's where we have been working on, you know, either do one or the other or a combination of both.
Yeah. What's your assessment of how, I want to say, how much better we have gotten as a society, as a global society, in access for treatment of regard for disabled persons?
Well, it's a very, very good question. I think that we started off well, mm-hmm. and I think the problem is still, there is still some problems. My problems, as I'm getting older, I suppose maybe the problem is more evident mm-hmm. to me, is interior architecture. You know, because we have this ADA things, which mm-hmm. is full of codes. And you know, codes are very nice, mm-hmm. but we are all individuals. You cannot put a disabled person as part of a code, mm-hmm. because each disability is different. So take me, for example, you know, if I go into a hotel and the bathroom is, quote, code accessible, meaningless. You know, because sometimes, you know, they say you put a couple of grab bars and it's accessible. Not true. So we have a lot more things, a lot more education, especially for architects who deal with interior design and so on, which I think sometimes it's almost like they don't know what they're doing.
Right.
So I've been unhappy a lot, and so I'm glad you asked me this question, because there's a lot more work to be done, lot more work.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question that might be the dumbest question I've ever asked, but I hope you will at least take the point that I'm trying to get at here, which is no one, if they had their druthers, would want to come into the world with legs that don't operate.
Mm.
I get that, and I'm sensitive to that. But I wonder if there has been a particular advantage, a particular joy, that has come your way over these years of living because it forced you to reconsider, reexamine, approach life differently?
It's a very good question, but I somehow don't think I'm dealing with what I have to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, am I happy that I'm unable to, do some running or play some mm-hmm. tennis or whatever? No.
Yeah.
But the thing is that this is not part of my life. My life, you know, I had polio when I was four.
Mm-hmm.
So the first 4 years, you forget about the first 4 years, especially as a kid, you know. Yeah. And, you know, the reality sets in from then until right now.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I'm doing what I have to do. Things are difficult for me, difficult for me to get into places, and so on. That's my life, you know.
Yeah.
So now am I, and I try to make my life as easy as possible. So I used to walk on stage for my recitals. Right now I have a scooter, so I scoot my recital. Life is really easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Mm-hmm.
So I work a little bit because I have to climb sometimes for the podium. That's more difficult. I do it. So, you know, I don't think about, you know, maybe this was better, maybe mm-hmm. It's something that I have to deal with and something that I have to adjust. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people tell me about, oh, isn't it heroic what you've been doing despite of what you've done? Mm-hmm. Not really. Mm-hmm. It's something that I have to do. We are not talking about that the talent is there. If I have, I've been lucky to be talented, mm-hmm. so I can play the violin nicely. Mm-hmm. And I can be a good musician and a good teacher and so on. But it has nothing to do with the fact that I can't walk. You know, I mean, this is, I always say, separate your abilities from your disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do.
So you're such a fascinating person. I could spend hours talking to you about life and never get to the music. Your fans wouldn't appreciate that, though. So let me talk about some music. I'm holding this wonderful CD in my hand.
Yes.
It's you and Martha Argerich. Tell me about this project.
Well, this is an interesting recording. It started off, in many ways, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we had Martha Argerich, of course, for those people who don't know who she is, and she's not a household name when it comes to that. She's probably the greatest pianist, one of the greatest pianists ever that play the piano. She is an amazing artist. Mm-hmm. She's just simply amazing. You know, her sound, her colors, the most incredible technique you've ever heard, and so on. So, and she'd been around, but you know, so we had a recital 20 years ago, and we played three pieces, and two of them were recorded, and one was not. And it was, as we say in the record business, it was in the can, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were waiting for a coupler. So 20 years later, we finally found a few things to couple, you know, and between her schedule and my schedule. So I went to Paris, and we sat down in the studio there, and we recorded the rest of the recording. So mm-hmm. there is a recording here, the Schumann Sonata, which is almost 20 years old, mm-hmm. and the rest is very new. Yeah. So it's a combination. Yeah. And I'm so excited about it because I love making music with her because she's so great.
When you hear your stuff from 20 years ago, this recording in particular, what do you hear? When you went back and heard it again, what did you hear?
I actually was pleasantly surprised. Yeah, actually liked it. Yeah. Because usually I hear something 20 years ago, I said, I'm not going to play it like that today. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
But this was, you know, this was a live concert.
Right.
The one from 20 years ago, mm-hmm. it was a live concert. And I said, this is pretty damn good. Yeah. You know, it's amazing. You know, it's because there was a lot of energy and from her, and of course I got my energy from her. Mm-hmm. You know, because she's such, you know, there's so much energy in her playing and so on. So I was very happy with it.
The most recent project from Itzhak Perlman, Violinist Extraordinaire, is with Martha Argerich, Schumann, Bach, and Brahms. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.